That's why you're gonna learn my next week. No, actually, have you had anything?
Yes, I have had like an undergraduate course, but it wasn't so advanced. So it was just some like basic.
Yeah, but it is good. I guess all of you have had some general activity, and yeah, I mean, I guess all you need is to look up Bayesian tensor in Maple. All of you have access to Maple, I guess, right? And I think they have. If you just look for Einstein in the hell.
But in my undergraduate course, they just taught geometry, whatever deals with J. But they didn't teach anything about the energy momentum tensor.
Yeah.
So that's why I've got problems with the Einstein.
But the energy momentum tensor you learned about, that's a stress tensor basically that you learned about in
fluid.
In the fluid, yes. So the spatial part of it at this is for components. The 0,0 component is just density. And the ij zero i components are basically rho times log. Well, I guess it's rho plus p times log. And the same here. And this is just the stress tensor. The ij component is the stress tensor that we learned about in this is just p delta ij. That you learned about in the fluid part. And the general form actually is in the covariant for perfect fluid, the covariant form of Kimi and U looks like this rho plus p. So this is energy density plus pressure times U mu U nu. This is the form velocity of the fluid minus P G. And so I guess gives more or less what you have there. Like it's P dot I j plus rho V I V j. So this gives you this product. So the spatial part is just the a stress tensor that I guess you saw in one of the earlier problems that it's in, I think, the beginning of the fluid section. So it was in problem. Section 3, problem 1. And so this is all you really need to know. Problem 1 is to know what T mu nu is, and you can find this in every book, in any book. And then you can just go to Maple and look for Einstein equation. You plug in the metric, it's gonna give you the Einstein tensor. Now, it's gonna be very good to actually try to calculate Einstein tensor once on the paper, but then it's up to you if you want to do that. Because, I mean, just doing this once is the definition of Einstein tensor is basically what I gave there, and it depends on this four index tensor Riemann curvature, which is defined in one of the problems that actually we are doing today. And by the way, so this is your freedom. So you didn't come to class last week?
Yeah, I was sick too, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you feel better now?
I feel better now.
Okay, well, that's good. I guess we're getting sick one by one. I wonder who's trying to say. So, good. So we have the missing three students. So I guess it's the three of you guys who can share this problem. upcoming. So, and I guess you should probably hand in problems at 6 today. Whichever of you, I mean, if you have it, hopefully you have it. Have you done it?
Yeah.
Okay. Have it, and or I guess you can just give it to me at the end of the class because we gotta go through these. Thank you. But so we'll I get them at the end of the class. So we have basically half of problems at 6 we are going through. It's so problem number 3, which is Padmanabhan's 5.3. We did our Paris was kind enough to do part B for us, which was yes. The part B was the derivation of the geodesic equation, right? So did you get to, I think you got to derive this gamma, this Christoffel symbol, right? And then we have a definition of this covariant derivative, which is, so let me just write it down. This is supposedly what we did, we almost did. Yeah, we did it probably almost a bit. At all. Last week. So it's just the definition of this Christoffel symbol, gamma I, kl. So Mina, in this the course that you took as an undergrad, was there a Christoffel symbol in it?
Yes, there was.
There was. Okay.
Yeah, because they're like basic.
About Einstein equation?
No, not so much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I guess the kinematic level, this Christoffel symbol is coming in, but I guess Einstein equation only you need to know if you want to find the metric. But then at the end of the day, all of them are just geometry, very complicated stuff. So these are so the definition of well the geodesic equation actually looks like this. If this is the velocity of a particle, the four velocity, a lambda is this some parameter, which well it's the proper time along the geodesic. So this is the geodesic equation, and this is what Paris derived last week, right? Yep, you remember. So this just you can just derive this by extremizing this action G R J. Now, what we have to go on to do, or it's just a definition of covariant derivative. That what I don't remember if we actually did it, but you can just look at this and just define uij as the regular derivative. So this is just a partial derivative for I can just partial ui partial j plus gamma j just a definition.
And of course, this equation takes the form. This equation would be equal to U, well, Uj, Ui. So this, if you just contract this definition by U, Uj, and sum over J, you get this equation, right? And I guess one thing I used is that Ui, Uj times partial Ui by partial xj. Since Uj was defined, is really defined, Uj is dxj by d lambda, and this is just dUi by d lambda. Just in shape, right? Okay. Then this definition is equivalent. Gives you the relativistic equation. That still doesn't tell us much. The interesting fact is that this is a tensor, which is something that's not obvious from the outset. But it's obvious that this must be this equation must be geometrically invariant because we obtain it by minimizing this action, which is which is coordinate independent. This is just a length between two points, right? Length or proper time, whatever you want to call. If you just minimize this, you get this equation. So that's a geometrical definition. So this must be, this equation must be covariant, basically. This is independent of coordinate system that you choose. But then it doesn't mean this is just a vector equation, but this is a tensor. So is it clear that this guy, which has a more general definition than this, every component of this is covariant? So that's, I think, one of the things that we have to show. So it says by spherical construction, the covariant derivative will be a tensor and defines a natural generalization of ordinary derivative together space time. How does gamma transform under a coordinate transformation? So the way to show this, of course, is to show that if you make a coordinate transformation, gamma is not a tensor that we knew because it has derivatives of metric in it. In general, if you change the coordinate system, metric changes by the changes in metric depend on the first derivative of the coordinate transformation. But then there will be second derivatives because of coordinate transformation due to these derivatives. So the change in gamma doesn't look like a change in tensor because it has second derivatives of the coordinate transformation. But then this combination, it happens that this combination does act like a tensor. Because if you do a coordinate transformation, of course, U is a tensor, and this is a derivative of U, and X, dx is also behaves like a tensor. What happens is that there are second derivatives of coordinate transformation that come in the transformation of gamma, but there will be also second derivatives because you're taking derivative of U, and it those cancel each other, and this combination actually. When you transform it, it just transforms like a tensor, or it only has first derivative for the transformation. Now that I think we have to show it explicitly. Has anybody done that? No.
Time system.
Yes. But is there any way we can argue that we don't have to do this? That, I mean, this is obvious. Is this obvious that this is a tensor? Or what do you guys think? So there is one component of this that's obviously a tensor, and that's the one along. So this is a tensor which has this 10 components, well, actually 16 components. There are four of them that we know act like a tensor, which are the ones in this direction. But this combination we know is a tensor. But this combination is followed from a geometric definition. But the rest of them is not obvious. So I guess, let's see. Can I come up with any? Yeah, I think really the only way is just to substitute and see that this term is canceled each other. Maybe there is an easier way.
So if UJ, UI, for any derivative of J is the polar fit of this tensor, and we know that UJ is also a tensor.
Mm-hmm.
So we can argue that it should be multiplied by a tensor as well. Because the other one.
So that's a reasonable argument if they were independent. And I think to some extent they are probably independent because, one is a derivative of another. So. Yes. So I think that's probably a good argument. To say that this is a tensor, and we know this is a tensor, so this is just a tensor product. So this must be a tensor as well. So I think that's a reasonable argument. And I guess the loophole in that is that these are not independent of each other. So I guess you could say that. So that argument in general wouldn't hold, for example, because let's say I say this vector so let's call it, I call A mu, assume A mu is 1, 0, 0, 0. In every coordinate. Now this is not a covariant statement because it changes in coordinates. But then this guy. What am I trying to say? Okay. I'm not sure if there's an exact loophole in the argument. But I guess that's reasonable. I think that probably the rigorous way of doing it is to substitute and see what's the coordinate transformation and show that it doesn't transform like a tensor. But okay, good. So now that we have this definition, let's go on to part C and see what it says. So we want the chain rule of differentiation to be valid, and the covariant derivative of a scalar should be the same as the ordinary derivative. Okay. So now we want to, if this is our definition, we want to find the covariant derivative of a covariant tensor. These are called contravariant tensors or contravariant vectors. The indices are upstairs. So what if the index is not downstairs? So who's gonna show, who can show that basically? Who can find for me the definition for the covariant derivative of a covariant? Can I do that?
I have done something.
Okay, good. Let's do it. Part C, perfect. my star. Thank you.
For that.
Just exchange the indices for
which indices?
Well, just I and J.
Oh, you just the name? Okay, sure.
Yeah, or just, you know.
And the next part is to show that for a tensor with some combination of covariant and contravariant indices, then for a general tensor, then you're going to have several gamma terms with positive or negative signs. How would we do that?
Thank you.
Okay, so I think we don't have to write the rest of it. So we know that basically the two terms that come out with gamma coefficients. But good, perfect. So you can have lots of different indices, and they all behave like products of vectors. And since we know how to do it for vectors, covariant or contravariant, that's going to tell us. So for every index, you get an extra gamma factor. If it's upstairs, you get positive. If it's downstairs, you get a negative gamma or gamma term. So now one thing is, I don't see it here. Maybe it's somewhere. So the covariant derivative of metric is zero. Why? Can we argue why? Is there an easy argument for why the covariant derivative of metric should be vanishing? Okay, so we know how covariant and contravariant indices are, or vectors are related to each other. So they're related by metric. So let's write that down and take its covariant derivative. Maybe that tells us something.
So it just gives this equation.
No, what I meant was that UI downstairs is GIJ times UJ upstairs, right? So covariant UI is just GIJ times contravariant UJ, right? Just write that. And then take the derivative, suppose, right? Yeah. Okay, so then let's use this to formulate that we have. But it's kind of like this, isn't it?
I think we should keep that one. We shouldn't change it because we want to show that that derivative is zero.
Mm-hmm.
But we should change just the left hand side and the right hand side. We have the definition of the left hand side. We have found it there.
Okay.
And then the other one is just GIJ multiplied by UJ. It lowers the index.
Okay, so we keep that.
That's right. So let's keep that one as it is,
okay,
and write the definitions of the other terms.
Okay.
Good. Well, so this is what we want to find. Fine. This is what we want to find. Okay. This we have a definition of. Right? This is just what we want to find. So let's keep this as it is.
Gij in uj, doesn't it just lower the index of uj? Lower g? Means it will be ui down?
That's,
b.
Well, that's true, but that means that you're already assuming what you want to get. Because basically, if Gij has zero covariant derivative, then it can enter. You can just put it in. But if it doesn't have zero covariant derivative, then there would be an extra term. So this is not as straightforward as you would hope it to be. But it's basically, it gives you a covariant derivative of Gij. But not, it's going to be a function of, you're going to have these derivatives of u as well. You're going to have derivatives of u as well. So I don't think it's going to be easier than just substituting through this definition. That's probably going to be not very different. So this definition, if you wrote that the last line, there would be two gamma terms. If both indices were downstairs, then both of them would be negative. And you could have substituted from up there. And what you would see is that they all cancel each other. Because they are all there, they have three derivatives of metric up there, and there are two gamma terms here. And then there is another derivative of metric, which is the first term that you get. And they all cancel each other. So I guess
this is the mixed tensor. It isn't a covariant tensor. TAB.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So if you could do this for a covariant tensor as well. It's very similar. If both indices were downstairs, yeah. You can do it, you just get just two negative gamma terms and everything would cancel. Okay. So that's, I guess that's also, I guess I cannot see any particularly illuminating way of seeing that, or shortcut to see that it's just simple substitution. So that's, and yeah, I guess I'm sure there's a shortcut to doing this. I haven't thought about it, and I guess this problem doesn't particularly ask you to do it. But just the general information, covariant derivative of metric vanishes. So you can indeed take metric inside and outside covariant derivatives and taking this is upstairs and downstairs. Is that right? I guess maybe it's just an easier way of saying that is because maybe now in the hindsight it was obvious. If you are right, Farrell was right that this combination say UJB. If this is a tensor, then this should be equal to UIB, right? Because this is how you lower and raise the indices of tensors. You multiply them with here. What you could have done instead is you can just write this as GIJ. Uj and everything covariant derivative. And since these two are equal to each other, then by definition, then Dij should have zero covariant. If you want to use chain rule, because chain rule tells you that this term is this term plus another term, which is the covariant derivative of the metric. Since that term is not present, that thing should be zero. So the fact that you can raise and lower indices of this covariant derivative. Okay, perfect. Now it makes sense. So the next part is somewhat more involved. Can you do it?
It's just tedious.
It's very tedious.
It's very tedious, but it's just basically a couple of questions have to exchange indices and subtract it from each other
So. Okay, so I guess what we want to do is to look at, I guess the point is that
So we drag all these properties of the covariant derivative. One thing that you wouldn't have expected from the beginning is that actually the covariant derivatives don't commute with each other. So if you take covariant derivative respective to you've got to take it twice with respect to two coordinate directions, two different coordinate directions, it's not going to be less x and y, let's say x and y. It's not going to be the same as a covariant derivative respect to y and x. And for a vector, the difference is quantified. Can you just write down this the equation that you're supposed to derive? And just want a third to write the result. Can you just write down the final? Riemann tensor. This is Riemann tensor. So it's a very important object in general relativity. It's a very important object in general relativity. Now the question is this a tensor?
Obvious.
Why is it obvious?
Those two are tensors on the left hand side.
Okay. Good. So basically, I guess for the same reason that that the covariant derivative was a tensor, this is also a tensor because it has a tensor definition on the left. But so why is it? Why do you think it's called? This is actually known as Riemann curvature. Why do you think this is called curvature? Well, okay, so we know it's a tensor. So if it's zero in some coordinate system, it's always zero in every coordinate system. So it's a geometrically covariant object. But then why do you think it's called curvature? I mean, when we say curvature, I guess what we imply is that if it's not in a flat space, it's zero, which is, I guess since gamma has vanished, but this in Minkowski space, gamma vanishes. But gamma doesn't vanish in general, does it?
In general flat space.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for example, you can go to a spherical coordinate system, and gamma is not the same. But then gamma is not a tensor, because coordinate dependent. But R is, so means that if you can find a coordinate in which gamma vanishes, then R vanishes, even if in general gamma depends on your coordinate system. So that's what's unique about this R, is that
it is a tensor and depends on gamma. So but it is just that it's curvature, that if a flat space so we can discuss different things. I guess the Max is gone. Sorry guys. So why is this called curvature? So at some level it just very intuitive. Thank you very much. I guess this is basically all the problem, but thanks a lot, Mina. So at a very intuitive level, basically, because if you can go to a coordinate system in which gamma has vanished, then that means R would be zero. That means R is zero all the time. So that means in a flat space, if you can make a coordinate transformation in which you recover a flat space, R is zero. But then it has also an interesting R itself, this particular definition of R, has an interesting interpretation. So what you're doing is that you're taking a vector and you move in two different directions. You first move in direction B, then direction C, and then you move in direction C, then direction B, and you see how much A changes. And of course, this is not a regular change, this is this covariant change. So it's not just changing the component A, it is this geometrically covariant change, which is defined here, basically, or defined here. And so what it basically tells you is that if you move in two different directions and look at how much A changes, so A is a vector. So A is this vector. It's a vector field, of course, it's defined every vector. You go in this direction and then you go in this direction, and you basically take the second derivative, see how much how much the gradient of A changes. And if you go in another direction and measure the same thing, you're gonna end up with different. You're going to end up with different numbers, and the difference in that is going to be the curvature. So that's now this is not a global concept because these coordinates rotate around, so you cannot define this globally. But let's see if we can make sense of this in a sphere where we know there is curvature. But essential care of the space is a sphere, right? And so let's see what would be the analog here. So what we want to do is to basically go somewhere from two different directions in a sphere. And see how much this vector, for example, changes. So I haven't thought about this too much, but let's see. That makes sense. Good. So there is this concept of parallel transport that people talk about that we didn't really cover today, or as another problem of the monogram. So now, can any of you tell me what is parallel transport? I guess you all had GR. So, what is parallel transport?
So, we want to, for example, if you want to differentiate a vector, well, this is covariant differentiation.
But that's covariant differentiation.
Yeah. We should first transport the vector.
Mm-hmm.
Parallel to its initial
position,
and then calculate the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So this is on that side of the plane.
Move along the direction of like tangent vector, so we find tangent vector and
that's reasonable. That's right. So I guess one okay, so I think an easier example than a sphere is just that parallel transfer is actually defined with this exactly like this. So when you're parallel transporting a vector, you're assuming that basically along the curve, let's say this is the curve of parallel transporting vector, you're assuming that px mu finds the covariant derivative of that vector, I'll call it dxi. Uj, and well, let's call it A, so that your vector is A. Aj, okay. This is zero. Okay. So, of course, if this vanishes everywhere, then this will be trivial. But in general, this is how you define parallel transfer. Yeah, that. So, for example, this equation, the geodesic equation, is the parallel transport of the four velocity vector. But you could have done it for any other vector, not just the four velocity vector. What this equation tells you is that if you basically use this equation, this is the way of defining this parallel transport. If you parallel transport the four velocity along the trajectory of a particle, you're going to get this four velocity very random. But you can do it for any other vector along any trajectory. And what it basically says is that you keep that vector as close as you can to its original direction. Right? Okay. So that's the definition of parallel transport. And what you can, for example, see is that, in the flat space, of course, this is a regular derivative. It says the vector doesn't change. An easy example is just a cone. You just take a cone. You can open the cone. And you know that if you take, say, if you look at transporting a vector along some trajectory, right, along some trajectory, which goes around the pole of the cone. Here, just parallel transporting means that the direction doesn't change. So the guy here, for example, let's look at the guy here. This guy is going to be... when you rotate it here along this trajectory, it's going to go to this guy, right? But then when you actually pass to the two sides of the cone, see that this is pointing to the left parts of this connection. This is pointing to the right parts of this connection. So what you're going to get is when you parallel transfer this guy, you're going to end up with this guy. Okay. So what it tells you is that basically if you take vector along a closed path, you're gonna end up with something different. And this is what basically this thing is parallel transporting a vector along a closed path. That you basically take this vector this way, this direction, and then take it this direction, and then come back at a different trajectory. And you end up with a difference, and that's quantified by that curvature. Now, so basically, what's going on here is Now these two are intuitively the same. I cannot. Well, actually, think a little bit to make this more clear mathematically. But let me not do that just yet. So I guess the point here is that this tip of the cone has curvature. And that's what you're saying. So if your closed path is anywhere else in the cone, you wouldn't see this effect. But only if the path goes around the tip, then you see this effect. And that means that your R, this R tensor, is vanishing everywhere except at the tip. Right. So this is the definition of, this is the physical intuition for curvature. Is that basically it's really taking vectors along closed loops. A small closed loops though, because these are derivatives, so these are defined for very small small displacements. And see how much vector changes after power transfer along a closed path. Okay, so now let's do something else, which is the last problem for problem 6. So it's Schwarzschild metric parts B and C, problem 5.11. It's really warm in here. So consider the motion of a material particle of mass m in the Schwarzschild metric. Show that the orbit of the particle can be determined from this equation. So who has done? Abbott, thank you. No chance? No, after that. It's not leaking.
I think you're on the right side. Keep going.
Yeah. So, look at static, isotropic gravitational field. And by this, we mean the metric can be written as.
Oh, you're doing part A, aren't you?
No, I'm just I'm skipping part A.
Okay. Because you're already assuming that you have a. We already know the form of metric, don't we? Let's go ahead.
Because I don't want to. Substitute for B and A until the end of my solution,
okay.
Because it makes it easier to write. So,
I guess you can just write down what B and A are.
Yes. So here, assuming that theta is constant, and as it is constant, I'm not writing the differential of theta in this equation.
Fine.
About B, if we want this matrix to satisfy the Einstein equation, one of the solutions will be the Schwarzschild solution, which gives B as this, A. So we can generalize this Schwarzschild metric by another metric called Robertson metric, in which A and B will be a series, like an exponential. In the last part of the part B, will above D with C, we will make use of that. But for now, we can use just the short chill.
Yeah, well, I don't think it'll make much of a difference.
So, so we want to find the equations of free fall. So in order to do that, we should find the thin connections for this matrix.
But you can just start on that from the action, right? So yes, and derive equations, right?
Well, I this was the solution of Padmanabhan, but it introduced some ansatz.
Which is?
Throughout the problem.
What is that?
Ansatz, it's just assumption. It assumes, for example...
what assumption?
A to B... et plus lv phi plus ar. So I didn't want to use this assumption because I don't know where it comes from. The energy.
That's funny, huh?
So I looked at some other books and found a more clear and logical solution.
Well, I mean, principally, you should have done it yourself, but okay.
Yeah, well, I did it mostly myself.
Okay. Good, good, that's fine.
So, about the gammas. So most components of gamma are zero, mainly because of this assumption here that theta is constant. The only thing non-zero components are
well. But wait a minute. Are you actually doing this for T? About 2 plus 1 dimensional metric or a 3 dimensional metric? Okay. Or 3 plus 1 dimensional metric. That's the metric that you're using, right?
Yes.
So you basically don't have a theta component. At all.
I have a theta component, but I can write it this way.
But I know that theta component doesn't really matter for geodesics because you.
I can write it this way to all the problem, and then at the end, as theta is constant, just put d theta 0. That's why I didn't write d theta when I put this.
So that's fine for geodesic equation because all you're doing, you're just if you're sitting, if it's a spherical symmetric metric, and you're sitting in the equatorial plane, then that's fine. Then it's all that matters is the metric in that plane. But in general, for example, if you want to write Einstein equation or things like that, the other components do matter.
Yes.
So this particular problem, the theta direction doesn't matter because you're sitting in the plane and there is no reason because of symmetry you cannot get out of it. But, okay. Yes. Good. Thanks. By the way, you can also calculate Christoffel symbols with that MathMapl. Did you do it by hand? Or?
No, just it's very easy. I didn't use MapL.
Mm-hmm. But I guess these are not that hard. Actually, it doesn't make much of a difference.
Yeah. Because G is diagonal.
Yeah.
Most components are zero.
Absolutely. Yes.
So it's very easy to.
Yeah, that's right. But again, I think it would have been easier if you just started from the metric, from the action, which is ds or ds. Just if action is integral of ds or ds squared, it doesn't matter. And you could have started that, but sure.
So for the
Schwarzschild
metric,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first component, the R. So these two equations are solved quite easily.
And you also have the the affine condition that gets dx, your dx mu by d lambda is unity, right? Yeah, by d lambda, this multiplied by itself is 1, right? Dx times. Yeah, so dx mu by d lambda times dx nu by d lambda times g mu nu is 1. G mu nu, yeah. Is that 1? I mean, that's what we assumed, or is a constant, I think. That's what we assumed to derive the JVC equation. That's the second, I guess, the condition that you have for lambda, right?
In deriving that equation, we assumed the lambda to be dS.
Yes.
But I'm not assuming this here.
But I mean, you're using that equation, aren't you?
I'm using that equation. We didn't need to do this to derive that equation. We did it for simplicity.
I'm not sure because I don't think you get, if that's not the case, then I don't think you can you get that equation. I don't think.
Here, what I'm supposing is that d lambda is a factor. Yes.
Okay. So that's a constant factor.
Yes.
Okay. So that doesn't make much sense.
Sure. But I want to.
But that is still a constant. Right?
I want to find this constant.
I see.
Because this is just a parameter which is changing its trajectory. I want to relate it to proper time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good.
So.
But then, I mean, you can always redefine lambda to get alpha equal to 1.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
But so you cannot really find alpha. I mean, alpha is arbitrary.
Yes.
Right.
I'm doing the redefinition here.
Well, okay. So I'll carry on. Let's see.
So for this equation, it's zero.
Mm-hmm.
So this is constant.
Well, let's see what do we have. Yeah. Okay.
This
okay.
is I've just divided by dt d lambda.
Yeah.
It
perfect.
Goes here.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have it, and this will give first term.
Okay. And the prime is derivative with respect to lambda.
To r. Because it gives us, write it down.
No, okay, it's fine, that's clear, good.
Okay.
Yeah. So is this fair?
So if this is constant, I will renormalize this, I will choose my alpha as this is zero. I'm doing it here. I'm choosing my alpha here.
Mm-hmm.
I want and n dt to the lambda plus n dt to be 0.
Okay.
So I've chosen my alpha. And that is why I will find it later.
Oh, okay. So that's a different choice. But okay, that's interesting.
So this will give me dt d lambda equals 1 over b.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1.
So that's an interesting equation, but one way that you could have gotten that was from the action. So your action doesn't depend on t.
Yes, explicitly,
right? So there is this there's a so-called no interference that whenever you have your action doesn't depend on the coordinate on one of your variables, then the derivative of the action with respect to the time derivative of that variable in the transform. So that's just the momentum. And that's what that is, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, you could have seen that here. Here your action was integral of b of r t dot b t by d lambda squared. And derivative of respect to b t by d lambda is just b t. That would have been one there. Right. This makes sense. You see what I'm saying? So what I was saying was that say if your action, your Lagrangian doesn't depend on some coordinate, they call it mu, or let's call it z. Let's call this is a function of x mu and x mu dot. But let's say it doesn't depend on x coordinate or z coordinate. Then the Euler Lagrange equations are in general these are the Euler Lagrange equations. What is it? This is d by d lambda. This is what I mean by that. Yeah. So this is then our order Lagrange equation. If your Lagrangian doesn't depend on some coordinate system, this vanishes. This is not there. So that means that since, for example, so there will be two constants here. Alright, so what are they? For this Lagrangian?
Energy and moment.
No,
angular
moment. Perfect. And that's what you're finding. So that's energy. Good.
That will give energy. That will give moment.
What is that then? It's number one.
That is alpha.
That's alpha. Okay. So that's not quite. That's a different kind of energy. Not, so I guess the two here. So you have an energy in general. So what we have here, we have two kinds of time here. We have the affine parameter lambda and we have actual t. And the fact that you're actually like Lagrangian doesn't depend on t and phi, they give you the two conservation. But then also since this doesn't depend on lambda, you just get another conservation. So But these are a little bit different. So the conservations that you have, one is because time our lambda is treated as differently from regular coordinates. But okay, so you have that condition. So what is?
We return to this one. It's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So ln divided to dr plus ln square, mm-hmm. is constant, mm-hmm. and this time I call my constant L, so L square, L. So this is the R squared, the change of phi in a trajectory, which will give the angular momentum. But it isn't the angular momentum that is used in the book, because in the book it takes L, this angular momentum, to be R squared d phi to dt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Or d tau. Okay, the proper time. Ds.
Yes. But
as my ds is different from my lambda
by a constant factor.
By a constant, this L will differ from this L by a constant.
Mm.
But we'll find it later. But
doesn't matter right now.
Okay.
You can just see that this is a kind of angular moment.
Either one.
Hello, what's up?
Was that here when you arrived?
Yes.
I think I'm not.
It's too late now, it's ours. Okay.
So this is one constant. And now we have found the change of phi and t in our trajectory. We have found this and this. So we can find the change of r in our trajectory.
Okay, so that's not conservation of energy yet. So that's just the first equation.
Yeah.
So that's just the equation of motion, which you can, if you integrate it, you get the conservation of energy. Right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So, but you could have, in principle, gotten the conservation of energy as well from the fact that this action doesn't depend on lambda. And that would have, I think that would have given you something. But go ahead, yeah.
So, let's rewrite first equation. So I've just replaced those terms. So again, multiplying this equation by 2a dr on v lambda. And this is a constant, and I call my constant minus.
Okay, so is this clear what Faber is doing?
Not the last part.
Okay, we want to differentiate this. It will give us differentiating a to lambda. Let me write it down.
Okay.
I'm going from here to here. Mm-hmm. So this is dA to d lambda dr d lambda squared plus the differentiate this one to dr d lambda dr d lambda squared a. Okay, so 2 this, and again, the second derivative of r, lambda, and minus a squared r, mean r of the lambda, and minus 1 plus 1 on b squared db and b lambda is equal to 0. Okay? So now I just replace this dA d lambda by dA
dr d lambda.
So this, I'm missing two. No, that's right. Okay. So as I multiply by this, here I should divide by this. And if I divide this term by this, I will have this term, because this is differentiating V to R. I don't have this, I've divided 2A and B squared. The same here. And the same here, the same.
So this is how you usually derive conservation of energy from the equation of motion. That's basically you multiply equation of motion by velocity. So it's usually both are vectors, but you can the dot product is a scalar. And then that's when you usually integrate it to a scalar equation. To a complete derivative, which in this case that's how it looks like. Now you can show that you can generally do that as long as your potential doesn't depend on time. Doesn't explicitly depend on time. Now you didn't really have to now the nice thing about this problem is that you could actually derive all these equations from these Noether's conservation. So that you have three conditions. One is that if you start from that action, basically integral of ds squared.
But what is my action?
Well, it's last week we decided that the action in general is just integral of ds, right? Which is the square root of this.
Yes.
But last week we argued that as long as d lambda is equal to ds or is proportional to ds, then you can also look at integral of, instead of, you don't have to take the square root, just this guy, integral of v dt y d lambda squared plus the rest of guys, d lambda, this is going to be your action. So basically, the square root doesn't matter, as long as d lambda is proportional to ds. Actually, we can just assume d lambda is ds, because lambda is just a parameterization. One vector is a vector parameter. So then you have basically three conditions. One is that ds is equal to d lambda. That's this is equal to d lambda squared. And then two other conditions, the conservation of angular momentum. The fact that this doesn't depend on phi, that means that dl by d phi r, partial l by partial phi r is constant. That's the same as your angular momentum. And the third one is that because this doesn't explicitly depend on t, so t is not, t now is like another coordinate here, because t also is some function of lambda. Partial this by partial t is constant, but partial t dot is constant. So that gives you three conditions. Mm-hmm. That's the three. There are three equations. That's all that you need, basically, to solve. So let me just write those down for you.
But there was one problem in that solution I can understand. We took at one point we took ds2 to be the special relativistic c of e squared minus e squared. We took this, we accepted this at one point to say that the derivative
that line doesn't necessarily, that's not necessary at all. I think that's just the motivation to call that d tau, that's not necessary. You can, I don't think that's used anywhere in the derivation. The only thing that's used is that d lambda is proportional to ds.
Because we integral of g dx dx, it's one on two integral multiplied by
that's right.
The delta of l.
That's right.
The same.
Yeah.
So we didn't pay attention to this.
Yeah, I think that's a constant.
That's a constant.
Exactly.
And why did we do this?
That's exactly what I'm saying. So ds by d lambda, that's the same here. Because lambda is arbitrary. So you can always choose a lambda that makes that a constant.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Okay. as long as our metric has no time dependence in static.
No, actually, you can always do that. You can always pick a lambda where n is constant. Now, of course, you do this after, you should do this after you find it minimum. So if you know what the geodesic is, you can parameterize it anyway. So that's always possible now. Man, I think that's the only thing that really matters. That you can always make choose any arbitrary lambda that you want. One particular choice that you can make the lambda be proportional to ps. And that gets a bit tricky because for photons, for example, ds is zero. Then you have to worry about it. But if you can think of photons as a limit of regular particles, but ds is not exactly zero. Then that's always possible. You can always take lambda to be the length along the path as a trajectory. Then basically, so what I was trying to say was that then you can say the direction is this. E dot squared minus A R dot squared minus R squared minus V lambda. And then you have three constants, partial L by partial T dot is constant. I don't know what it's called. But what would be, I don't know what would be the equivalent to those constants that you have, but this is going to be basically just BT dot partial L by partial phi dot. This is going to be R squared or minus R squared phi dot. And then the third one is just that this is fun. BT dot squared minus AR dot. Now, is that enough to give you all the equations that you need? I think so, right? Because I can just factor out the t dot here. I can factor out t dot the squared, which is this constant divided by, I don't know what we call this, m. So if I factor out t dot, it's going to be m divided by b squared, t dot squared, times b minus a dr by b squared, minus minus r squared, d phi by d. And I guess d phi by dt is just, you can get that by dividing this guy with this guy. That's just going to give you d phi by dt as a function. This is another constant. So, this is another way of finding the same equation from the action. All you need to know is the fact that we have this, you have this, I guess you could call it gauge constraint, that lambda, you pick this lambda, which is arbitrary to begin with. To be proportional to ds, or to be actually exactly the same as ds, and then you have two other constraints, which is the fact that this doesn't depend on t and phi, that means that these two are constant. And this is going to be equivalent to this what would that appropriate? I think actually this is right now, these two are equivalent, right? If you just take this equation, t dot substitute from here, this is going to be 1 over b, or some constant over b. And this is going to be just a times r dot squared. And this is just going to be this constant divided by r squared. So this is another way of getting the same thing. Perfect. Well, sorry for interrupting you. But
So it does help to use the accent sometimes, because you can see that the symmetry is more immediately, and that simplifies. You look puzzled.
I understand what you're saying.
You do understand or you don't understand?
I understand.
Okay, good, good. That's why you look puzzled. Okay.
So one thing about this E, if we just write E squared plus B, E squared is the thing, square squared, I squared, mm-hmm. and just we have just found the rate of change of T and R and phi to mm-hmm. In trajectory, and if we divide by D lambda square, we just find that this is E lambda square.
Mm-hmm.
Just
good. So,
so that constant that was So this is 1 over alpha squared or something.
Okay.
So and as you see, if E is positive, it means that my particle has mass. It's a material particle.
Mm-hmm.
And if E is zero, it will be a photon. So what was strange in the solution of Padmanabhan was that if from the first step, there was an M and an M. This M created the gravitational field, and that M was the test mass put in that gravitational field.
Yes.
But here, as you see in my solution, there is no M.
There
was just this M creating the gravitational field.
But
so
there's
this
a small M is just in the definition of the constants.
Yes, this is the M.
Yeah, so but also this L, for example, the angular momentum is, I mean, you can say it's mass times velocity times radius. I mean, I think that's the only reason that this small M is coming somewhere. But it's just in it redefines your constant. It's not, it doesn't really play any role.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Okay, so.
So what is this effective potential?
Yeah. What we want is dr over dt. We want to find the rate of change of the radius in time.
Mm-hmm.
This is just dr over d lambda, dt over d lambda.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found these two. So we just got to divide these two.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then you find this result that there is in Padmanabhan.
Yeah, but you should just change these constants into the constants of Padmanabhan. And the change is this E. Will be, I put the all the N in the definition of E, I think maybe a mistake, but if you choose your constants like this, this is the energy of Padmanabhan, and L has, if you change your constants this way, it will be exactly that description. So
there is an effective potential. So can you plot this effective potential? I first write it down and then make a plot of it.
We are plotting is the matrix M to R over N assume that GB is 1. This is 1. And then, something like but but if it was Newtonian, it would have been this way.
Okay.
This is the Newtonian one. This is GR. If our energy is less than M, this would be the intersecting line, and we will be orbiting between these two points. This will be closed. Elliptical part.
But that's not necessarily, it wouldn't be necessarily closed, because to have a closed orbit, you need, it doesn't necessarily return to the same point, because for that to happen, you need radial frequencies and angular frequencies to be the same. And that's a special for Keplerian orbit, but not necessarily for any other radial potential.
So we can have orbits like this.
Yeah, you can have precession, basically. At large distances, this is just a precession. This is a famous Mercury, for example, precession, that helium precession that was observed and was one of the first evidence for GR. That it's not an exact ellipse. The axis of the ellipse rotates slightly with time. Of course, as we get closer, then this rotation gets very fast, and so it's not as small. It's going to be a very big effect.
Mm-hmm.
But basically it means that your orbit doesn't close on itself because these two frequencies are the same. I guess one thing I could have asked you for you to do is to just calculate this Mercury precession. It's going to be too difficult, but anyway, that's a different course.
So if E is like that, which means that E is bigger than M, but smaller than V max, the object will come closer to us and then return. And that's where there's a difference between Newtonian and Newtonian gravity and general relativity, is that if E is bigger than V max in GR, the object can go to zero. R can go to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But in Newtonian gravity, there will be always an intersection with the side of the object in return.
Yeah.
So that is the one of the differences between GR and GR.
So can you find the position of that maximum?
This is just the V to the R equals zero.
It's a bit curious because this potential doesn't. Well, it's not really an effective potential because there is also an R dependence in. Is it? No, but the R dependence doesn't.
There is the L dependence.
Yeah, there is
L changes.
Yeah.
This curve changes. For example, if L is smaller, you have this. Then
Yeah.
These are different.
So for zero n, basically there is no maximum. So there is some L that has a maximum. So basically it means that, okay, so there is a minimum angular momentum.
I think L over G M should be bigger than 4. Because that shape
to give a maximum, otherwise you don't have a maximum. That sounds reasonable. I'm not I don't remember the number, but basically the idea is that in order to not fall into the black hole, you need to have a minimum angular momentum, because if you don't have zero angular momentum, you just fall into the black hole. So if it was a point particle, then any small angular momentum would blow up, basically, would eventually lead you to avoid the center. But since the black hole has a finite size, then if your angular momentum is smaller than something, even though you're not directly falling in, your angular momentum is not, your angular velocity is not high enough to avoid the black hole. So you get into the horizon. So that's why there is a minimum. That's the meaning of the minimum angular momentum. But something else that's interesting is so the circular orbits are, so where are the circular orbits? So let me ask you.
You mean if
do we have a still circular orbit or not?
R is 0.
Yes.
Yes, we can have a circular orbit.
So where would they be sitting?
See, where was the R to dt?
But you have a formula for it. But I mean, just based on that shape of the potential, can you tell me where the circular orbit will be?
No.
So it means that R should be constant, basically. So where would it be?
R should be. Yeah. It should be.
At the minimum.
Oh. If R is not changing in time, I should draw a vertical line.
Yeah, but okay, so in general, you have all these, so you categorize these different possible orbits, right? That the ones that you have a maximum radius and a minimum radius, the ones that you have a minimum radius
yes.
and no maximum, and then there are ones that there is no minimum
yes.
radius
yes.
or maximum radius. Right?
Yes.
So which one does the circular orbit fit in? Which of these categories?
The one...
Or nearly circular orbit. Which one of these categories would it be?
Can you ask the question again?
So you have three categories of orbits.
Yes.
You showed them there, right?
Yeah.
The ones with the maximum and the minimum
yeah.
radius. The
yeah.
one with just a minimum radius.
Yeah.
And there is one with no maximum or minimum.
It's this one, but these two are equal. The two R's are equal.
So that
this curve will change.
But this curve, you fix it, if you fix L, you fix that curve. Right?
Yes.
So let's say for a fixed L, where would be the circular orbit? So you do you guys know where
it's at the minimum.
It's at the
minimum. Because the derivative is zero.
The derivative is zero, and also the maximum and minimum will be the same because. For anything larger than the minimum, there is a maximum and a minimum that are different. So if you just bring down the energy level to its minimum, then the maximum and minimum. That's the only, then you cannot be, since your energy is a maximum, gives you, is the maximum potential energy that you can have. The total energy is a maximum potential energy. So if the total energy is a minimum of potential energy as well, since the kinetic energy is zero. dr by dt is zero, basically. So that's what it means. Okay, perfect. So, but then what's interesting here is that you have two possible, let's see.
Okay, so now you have a maximum for the potential and also a minimum for the potential. Okay. So, do you have a circular orbit at the maximum as well or not? That doesn't make sense. That's
what I'm thinking of is that this, we just put dr to d around lambda to zero to see what happens.
But it's so unstable. I think it's not visible at the maximum point. You know, that it's going to fall down into
the black hole.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
At the minimum point, it's just visible.
So that's one thing, that there is a stable and an unstable. I mean, one thing, as you say, you can just plug in dr by d lambda, set that equal to zero. So I think there's an equation which you covered, and it's in the middle board, and you can just set that equal.
Yeah, but I didn't find it.
Yeah,
I d lambda.
Yes.
I should use this. So this should be zero. This should be zero. So what happens is that because it's on the basis of my E, so
that's fine. So now here's the deal. So what I wanted to get to,
the R that satisfies this equation. We should. How many answers does this equation have?
Well, let's see. I think it has three answers. Because it's a third order equation. No, but yeah. No, it's a third order equation. But that's not going to be easy to find it. Okay, so here's something we can, that maybe we're going to discuss in the afternoon session. So there is, for circular orbits,
yes.
There's a minimum radius, basically, for which they are stable. Okay. So,
the minimum radius?
There's a minimum radius for which they are stable.
Minimum energy?
Either one.
Yeah.
There's either one. Or a minimum angular moment. So, the curve that you were showing, if you just go back to the curve that you were showing. So this is a function of L, so for different L's, you're going to get different values, different curves. There is a minimum value of L, I guess, for which you do have a minimum there. So I guess that's the number that you wrote there. If L is smaller than something. So what is interesting, and it's very important, is what is the radius associated with that? And I guess you can just, so you have that condition already. And
the radius associated with what?
With that point, basically, where the transition happens.
Because it's independent of radius.
But the radius of the minimum, I mean. So there is a minimum radius or minimum angular momentum for a stable circular orbit. Below this, there is no stable circular orbit. And that's where people think the edge of accretion disk in black holes are, basically. So you have the accretion disk that you discussed over about a month ago. So they are everywhere, basically, around a black hole. Whenever you have circular orbits, then you could have gas basically going around in stable circular trajectories. But then if the radius becomes smaller than some value, which is given by, basically, by that this equation, basically this condition, I believe,
this gives you the minimum angular momentum, and if you plug in here, assuming the condition here, it gives you the radius.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get a minimum radius for accretion disk. So that sets the edge of accretion disk. And now, but we did this for the Schwarzschild metric, but you could have in principle done it for the metric which had rotation in it. And this radius would depend on rotation, how fast the black hole would rotate. And this is how people measure the rotation speed of black hole, that where this edge is. That basically, where you stop having, basically what happens is this gas slowly falls, spirals into the black hole, but then when it reaches this point where there is no stability, it just falls in. So the accretion disks are truncated at that radius, and that radius depends on how fast the black hole is. So if you did repeated this exercise for a Kerr metric, which is for a rotating black hole, then you would see that this radius and that angular momentum depends on how fast the black hole rotates, and this is how we can measure the rotation speed of the black hole. So that's very important and useful, and it's really just a start from that potential. That if you where it's stable and where you stop having a stable circular orbit. Well, yeah. Well, it depends on what you mean by that. But in principle, yes.
Okay. And how does it affect the accretion disk in different
horizons? It's going to be different. So the metric that we started with, which was this one, I think, it's going to look a bit more complicated, and it's not going to be a spherical symmetric anymore. It's going to be, because there is a rotation axis now. It's going to be azimuthally symmetric, but not a spherical symmetric. And I guess that's really something else we don't really have time to get into. There is going to be event horizon, but there are going to be other spheres in which you can have like energies become negative. So in principle, I guess it's called ergosphere. So you can inside that energy can become negative. So they could have funny effects happening, but that's it's harder to imagine from especially from Newtonian intuition. But all you need to know is that this metric becomes a bit more complicated, and you can just go through the same analysis and come up with that effective potential. But what turns out that the minimum angular momentum is not going to be the same, it's going to depend on the spin of the black hole. And that's how people basically measure the spin. There are going to be more complicated effects that you can do a whole course on. Yeah. But interesting, good. So we're going to meet, thank you. So we're going to meet in an hour. Thank you very much, Farber. This was perfect. I think we have part C still, right? Or did we finish that?
No, we haven't.
We haven't. What is that?
Find the deflection
angle. Okay, good. So we can do that at next session. And then I can talk a little bit about Einstein equation and the next problem. So. Okay. Okay, good.